time once again for Community Forum, and we're very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Paul Zaremka. Paul Zaremka is a professor of economics at the State University of New York at Buffalo. He has been the general editor for Research in Political Economy since 1977 and is the author of Toward a Theory of Economic Development, editor of Frontiers in Econometrics, and co-editor of Essays in Modern Capital Theory. And he is here to talk about his book, The Hidden History of 9/11. Paul, thank you very much for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Start out, if you would, and tell us, what was your motivation in being the editor of The Hidden History of 9/11?
Actually, I didn't have a direct motivation to do it. I mean, it wasn't like I planned to do it and then I got the authors. It was the other way around. There was maybe 30 or 40 academics that were discussing 9/11 on the internet, and somebody suggested that we do a book. And I, as general editor of Research in Political Economy, which is published by a major academic publisher, Elsevier, could offer the publication of whatever we wanted to do. And I knew that Elsevier would not cause any trouble with the content of it, because they never have. So basically, it kind of fell into my lap rather than any other than a planned project. And then the issue was who would do what, and that's a long story that's not worth telling. But it's
all right. But you also contributed to
it. Yes, of course, I contributed to it also. And also, I will just say that when I say it just dropped in my lap, I can't say that. The editor really does have a lot of responsibilities beyond his or her own individual chapter. I mean, he has to get the book ready for preparation. He also has to write prefaces, figure out what order the chapter should go in. That was sort of one of my major contributions, was figuring out how to present the topics that are in this book.
All right. So tell me, so what do you think is some of the most damning information that contradicts the U.S. government's official story on what happened on 9/11?
I don't like to focus on any one item that's the most damaging. What I find is that different people come to the issue about what happened on 9/11 differently. For example, I know people who think that the fact that there was no military defenses that were at all effective on 9/11, a very damaging item, and it is damaging. But other people would find that the fact that there were three towers that fell that day that looked like exactly like a controlled demolition, not just two, by the way, there was three on 9/11 that fell just like a controlled demolition, overwhelmingly convincing. Others find the identity of the hijackers a major problem. So it really depends upon where the person is coming from. But what I like to do is present the spectrum of issues, and I think it all forms a pattern which people have to know about.
All right. You mentioned the identity of the hijackers, and that's one of the first chapters in the book. Can we...
Right. It is the first chapter. Okay.
Can we go into that some more?
Right. That's exactly one of the things that I had to decide what to go first. And the reason why I decided to make that chapter first is because that's the way the dialogue is discussed by the government. The government talks about the fact there was bin Laden and 19 hijackers that took over these planes and crashed them into the towers, into the Pentagon, and led to the flight and falling in Pennsylvania. But the first chapter is done by a person who is very expert in watching evidence from videotapes. And there's very serious problems with the identities of those 19 people who were alleged to be on those planes. And I'm going to always say, if I don't make a mistake, I'm going to say alleged hijackers. Because, first of all, how do you know that any of those people were on the plane? The government has never provided authenticated manifest of people on the plane other than the passengers. In other words, they gave you the manifest for the four flights for everybody except the supposed hijackers. So there's no direct evidence that's even in the public domain of who was in the seats that they claim were in the seats. I'm talking about what the airlines themselves had. That's one problem. The next problem is that the government provides videotapes, security videotapes, for two people in Portland, Oregon, who boarded a plane. One was the famous Atta, and another hijacker named Al Amari. They show a video, a security video of them going through the Portland security, supposedly to go to Boston, and then from Boston get on to flight American Airlines Flight 11. But that doesn't tell you anything about whether they were on Flight 11. It tells you that they were on the flight from Portland, Oregon to Boston. I mean, I can sort of simply say, kind of like, so what? Okay? They may have had reasons to be on that flight. It was also very strange that they would take a rental car, go from Boston to Portland, Oregon, and then fly back. I mean, it just, it's a strange behavior. And so that's another problem, that the identity that's portrayed is not people entering the flights that were the flights that went into the towers. There was also videos from supposed security in Dulles Airport of several of the hijackers, and those videos don't have a date stamp on it, don't have a time stamp on it, don't show you, don't have the usual things that a security camera would have. And furthermore, the video shows pictures of cars coming to the airport in as if it were maybe like 11 o'clock in the morning or 2 o'clock in the afternoon, something like that, in terms of the shadowing of the cars that are arriving. But in fact, that they arrive supposedly it's around 7:13 a.m. on 9/11 to catch their flights, and that's only a half hour after sunrise. And you would have very long shadows of cars. So, in other words, just looking at the video itself doesn't match. So, there may be videos of those people going through security some other time and then just plugged into as if it was part of the record. Those videos, by the way, came out one day before the 9/11 Commission actually made its report. So, that's that. All of that suggests a problem, but even more seriously, 10 of the hijackers showed up alive somewhere in the world after 9/11. I mean, that means individuals would, for example, it's reported by BBC, by the LA Times, by a Saudi newspaper, I believe also by the Independent in England, that people who were stated to be the hijackers and identified not just by a picture and a name, but also by maybe their school, what city they live in, you know, is kind of a more elaborate definition of these people. They read themselves in the newspapers having been a hijacker, and they were astonished and went to the American embassy or went to the newspaper or whatever, and 10 of people report that they're alive afterwards. And when you get to, I'm getting kind of emotional now because I get really angry at this, when you get to the 9/11 Commission report, there is no discussion of evidence for these individuals. It just assumed that everybody agrees on the list of 19 people and then goes on and makes a discussion about what they did. And even the director of the FBI says we have no proof that these people were actually the people because there could be stolen passports involved. And some of these individuals said that their passports had been lost, so are possibly stolen. So there is a real problem with identity. And if there's a real problem with an identity, then that means that those people could be basically anybody. And then finally, the pilot of flight United Airlines 93 that crashed into Pennsylvania hills, the government provides various documents about what he looks like. Passport, visa, student, a picture of him as a student. The author of the first chapter has 7 different pictures of him, and you can see that they're not all the same individual. They're all identified as Zara, but there's 3 different people in those identities. And the 9/11 Commission, the government never addresses that. Now, we're not claiming that Zara was one of the people that survived, because he never raised his hand later saying, I'm alive, okay? But it looks like he had doubles. So I need to give another example. His passport was one of the passports that was found in the wreckage of Flight 93, supposedly. But in fact, 93 disintegrated so badly that they couldn't even find the plane. I mean, even the parts of the plane, except certain parts in the Pennsylvania field. So it's, again, the identity of the hijackers is highly questionable. And evidence is not provided.
All right. If we could next move on to one of the chapters you wrote that focused on insider trading. Can you talk about that?
Yes. I'm an economist, and one of the reasons why I would consider myself capable of writing about this topic is that I did do this book on econometrics, and I know the relationship of economic theory to statistical theory. So one of the things you do when you look at financial evidence is use some kind of statistical techniques. Insider trading means that somebody engages in a financial transaction in which they expect to benefit from either the rise or the fall of a stock price, or I'm going to talk about put options in a moment, because they have information other people don't have. The focus of people's attention after 9/11 was on put options. Put option means that I have the right to buy a stock many days in the future, maybe a month in the future, maybe 3 weeks in the future, at a time of my choice until a certain date at a certain price, any time in that time interval. And at the same time, I could... I would sell the stock, but I could buy it at the same day to basically cover the position. So, for example, United Airlines and American Airlines were about $30 on the stock market. Both of them is kind of interesting, but both pretty close to the same. Before 9/11, they fell to about $18 after 9/11, both of the stocks, more or less. So if you had a put option that you would have the right to sell American Airlines stock or United Airlines stock anytime after 9/11 at $30 when the stock then is trading at $18, then you would make a $12 profit on every one of these transactions. So buying a put option does is to say, I will decide in the future whether I want to sell the stock at $30, depending upon whether the market has gone down to substantially, like, for example, 18. So if you know ahead of time that American Airlines and United Airlines are going to have big problems in the future, nobody else knows it, you can make a killing. And there was very substantial put options on American Airlines and United Airlines before 9/11. And in my book, The Hidden History of 9/11, I have some pictorial representations of the extent of that. Now, what's really interesting is that this is something that was in the major financial press, like Barron's. I mean, it was a well-stated problem before 9/11. And I think the reason why it was so alarming is that, first of all, the level of put option trades is public knowledge. I mean, it's a little bit complicated, but I don't want to get into the complications. It's not exactly so easy to know, but more or less, you can know that it was really substantial before 9/11. For about a month, there was a lot of discussion, and I think the reason was that they figured out to follow the money. The money would immediately lead to bin Laden, and we could convict bin Laden of this operation by finding out that he was behind the trades. Suddenly, it stopped. I mean, you hear nothing else about that. And even when you get to the 9/11 Commission report, which is 3 years later, they have just one sentence about put option trading, because it was in the press. They had to say something about it. And then they have a long footnote, and that's it. No serious investigation of those put options. And I think the answer is that the word came kind of out to the people who were doing it, that don't go there. In other words, they were saying that if you really followed the money, you wouldn't get to bin Laden. I don't know who you'd get to, but I mean, it's a speculation on my part, because I don't know. All I know is that the discussion stopped, And when it got to the 9/11 Commission report, they did a totally inadequate job of describing what was happening. And yet the put option volumes were, I mean, we're talking like 60 to 90 times normal patterns for those. I mean, big, we're not talking about percentages. I'm talking about 90 times the normal levels. So there is a professor of business at the University of Illinois Champaign who looked at the evidence of insider trading ahead of time, and he had access to data that even normal people, normal academics, can't have access to, because the Chicago Board of Trade, which handles put options, gave him some confidential data, I think partly because they really want to understand whether they can identify insider trading in any kinds of stock before it happens. I don't know. But anyway, he has confidential data, and he did a statistical analysis of whether insider trading occurred with high probability before 9/11 or not. And his answer is the probability is like 99% that it did indeed happen on one of the airline stocks, and close to maybe not, like 90 or 95% on the other airline's stock. So in other words, and take that as a joint probability, the probability is less than 1% that those events were random. And I want to emphasize that, because, I mean, I'm an academic, and we're not saying here something that's certain. We're not saying absolutely with certain it occurred. We're saying that the probabilities are so low that it did not occur that it deserves very serious investigation. So then we have two other professors in Zurich who are in the process right now of examining many other financial stocks, and in some cases confirming what this Professor Potasman from the University of Illinois Champaign found, and in some cases for other stocks not finding it. But in general, it increases the evidence that there was insider trading that occurred before 9/11. And I want to point out that Potasman's paper was published in the Journal of Business, which is a totally normal academic, highly professional journal. And I haven't seen any response to it. I haven't seen anybody who says he's wrong or whatever. You know, it's just being ignored in the academic world as far as I know.
Now, did someone unknown, did they cash in on that? Because I think I had heard originally that there was some of those that no one ever claimed.
I don't think that's correct.
Okay.
I mean, I did my own checking of the... you can not only know the financial transactions that took place on a day, but you can also find out what they call open interest. In other words, how many positions are there out there that could still engage in a transaction? And they did decline afterwards. So when you got to the date, which is what they call the strike price, I mean, I lost the word for the moment, but the day in which the transaction has to be engaged in or you lose it, by that time most of them had fallen down to normal numbers of open interest. So I think whatever happened did transpire.
Okay, and then the one other criticism I've heard of this is that traditionally that time of year there are a lot of transactions like this in general, because it's like near the end of a quarter or something, so it isn't unusual. Have you heard anything about that?
I didn't even hear that. I don't think that's credible.
Okay. All right. Anything else on that?
No.
Move on to talk a little bit about that there were military drills happening the day of.
Yes, we have a chapter on the military drills that took place on that day. Now, what is astonishing is, I mean, everybody can suspect that the government has military drills all the time for all kinds of different possibilities. What was found out is that there was it's a little bit ambiguous, but something like between 5 or 6 and 8 distinct military drills that were scheduled for exactly 9/11, which took the American defenses away from their normal positions on that day, and further would have the possibility of confusing any air traffic controllers or military controllers about what was actually happening that day. So there's substantial evidence that somebody set up a lot of military drills to occur precisely on 9/11 so that nothing really took place in terms of defending America's airspace on 9/11. And what I'm going to just mention here a minute, the first identification that there was a hijacking was at 8:20 in the morning, more or less, within 2 or 3 minutes, 8:20 in the morning for American Airlines Flight 11. The American Airlines Flight 11 crashed into the towers at 8:46. The plane that went down in Pennsylvania crashed at 10:06. So we're talking about a space there of an hour and 46 minutes between the very first crash and the last one. And the crash in the Pentagon was at 9:38. So you're talking about between the identification of a hijacking and the crash into the Pentagon of about an hour and 10 minutes. And yet the American military was not able to defend any of those events, any of those sites. That's just absolutely unbelievable, to tell you the truth. The Pentagon even has surface-to-air missiles that can knock out anything coming toward the Pentagon. And so then you raises the question, well, why didn't it work that day? And actually, there's an interesting theory about that, and that is that if a military plane comes near the Pentagon, it sends out a beam which tells the air defenses of the Pentagon, we are friendly. So it could have happened that day that actually whatever hit the Pentagon, and that's a whole another story about whether what is alleged to have hit the Pentagon is exactly the correct plane. I mean, it's a longer story than I think we can get into, but some people think that actually the plane that went into the Pentagon wasn't flight American Airlines 77, but was in, which would not have been able to have sent out a signal of friendly to a military installation, the Pentagon, but there was something else which was able to send out that signal that it is friendly, and therefore avoid the air defenses operating. But so what I'm saying is that, first of all, planes didn't knock out or intercept these planes, the four planes, and secondly, that air defenses of the Pentagon weren't operative. So how's that possible? Now, as your readers are listening to me, I mean your listeners are listening to me, maybe one of the things I'm saying now makes more sense than another, and that's what I'm not trying to say which is the most interesting. I'm just trying to offer the spectrum of issues. And that leads me to another major issue, and that is that we had not two towers that collapsed on 9/11 at the World Trade Center, but in fact three. World Trade Center 1, World Trade Center 2, World Trade Center 3. And what's astonishing, now I began watching for what really happened on 9/11 about in January of 2002, and I wrote a preface to one of my research volumes in October of 2002, thinking that I was sort of covering at least some of the questions that were being asked about 9/11, and I did not even know then that there was a third building that had collapsed. So there's been a silence about this third building, which is World Trade Center 7. Now, the important thing is, forget all about what the government says. Just look at the collapses of the buildings themselves, World Trade Center 1, World Trade Center 1, 2, and 7. They look like controlled demolitions. I mean, they look like not an accidental collapse of buildings because they've been hit by a plane. And by the way, World Trade Center 7 wasn't hit by any plane anyway. They look like somebody set off charges which led those buildings to collapse. And they even collapse at almost free fall speed. In other words, it wasn't like a building sort of creaks and sways and then starts to fall, and one side falls sooner than the other side, and it then tilts over or anything nothing like that happened. It was so perfectly collapsed that it's unbelievable that it would happen even once, but it happened three times in one day. I mean, it's frankly unbelievable. Okay, and so I think one has to trust one's own judgment. Just look at it. Forget about all the propaganda out there. Just look at it as a normal human being, and you say this is a controlled demolition. And in fact, news reporters on that day said that. They said this looks like a controlled demolition. And they were probably thinking, oh, maybe we got terrorists who are in the buildings who set up charges in the buildings. Okay, they don't go there. The mainstream press doesn't go there since then, but their normal reaction is probably the healthiest reaction to have. So anyway, examining the collapse of those three buildings. And by the way, one of the buildings was not even hit by the plane directly. It was hit kind of on a side of the building, and a lot of the jet fuel went into the air. It didn't go down to the building in any case. So you would clearly expect, that's a World Trade Center 2, you would clearly expect that building not to fall straight down. I mean, if that one of all buildings would go in some kind of funny fashion. And even one of the buildings, I think this is World Trade Center 1, the initial movement was at something like a 22-degree angle, and then suddenly it's all straight down. It's amazing. It's really amazing.
Only a couple minutes left. Have you taken, since you came out with your, we just came out with the paperback edition of your book, The Hidden History of 9/11, and you had the hardcover edition out for a while. Have you taken a lot of flack from those you work with at the university from your work here?
No, actually. Maybe some people would be surprised. But there's a reason for that. I mean, I'm an officer of my union. I'm in what they call the grievance officer for academics. And when you build, over the years, I've built up a reputation at the university, and if you want to say, at least, I think general respect, if nothing else, by the fact that I was voted into these offices, and that helps, to be able to withstand that. And of course, there are people who disagree with me, but it's a respectful disagreement. I'm sure that behind the scenes, people are saying very dismissive things. But has anything actually happened to me at the university that I can concretely identify? No.
All right. We are talking with Paul Zaremka, and he is professor of economics at State University of New York at Buffalo, and also the author of The Hidden History of 9/11. And he is speaking tonight here in Seattle at 7 o'clock at Trinity United Methodist Church in Ballard, which is at 6512 23rd Avenue Northwest. That's happening at 7 o'clock. So people can turn out for that and have a chance to hear more on the different chapters within your book, as well as I would assume you'll be fielding some questions and answers.
Yes, sure.
Very good. Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you very much for spending time with us this morning.
Well, thank you very much. I really enjoyed it.